From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, please let me say a sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
It doesn't matter what custom you've got. It doesn't matter what holy thing that you worship and adore. The gays are going to get it. They're going to make you conform to them. You're going to say you like anal sex, you like oral sex, you like bestiality, you like anything you can think of, that to whatever it is, and sooner or later you're going to have to conform your religious beliefs to the group of some aberrant thing.
This week marks the launch of a special State of Belief series that we're calling Whosoever You Love. As political religious right forces in this country converge to pose a very real threat to the hard-won rights and dignity of LGBTQ persons, we are committing to amplifying the voices of hope and inspiration that are so badly needed today. And we'll debut this series later in the hour with beloved author, activist, and retired Episcopal Bishop Jane Robinson. As we watch events unfold that even those with many decades of experience can only call unprecedented, how is all of this affecting younger Americans? I'm looking forward to getting some firsthand impressions from C.J. Wexler, who is just completing an internship at Interfaith Alliance, and who wrote movingly about watching the Supreme Court recently rule in favor of the Trump Muslim ban. But first,
I'm pro-life. I don't apologize for it. And I'm proud to be part of a pro-life administration that's advanced pro-life policy.
You still want Roe v. Wade to be overturned?
Well, I do, but I haven't been nominated to the Supreme Court.
Right, but you're
Judge
part of the
Kavanaugh
administration
has.
That campaigned, you and the president
that's
campaigned,
right.
Saying
right.
You will find nominees to overturn Roe versus Wade.
This week, Donald Trump announced his nominee for Justice Anthony Kennedy's seat on the Supreme Court. In an announcement hyped in advance like a pivotal moment on some reality show, 53-year-old Brett Kavanaugh's name was put forth for what Mitch McConnell had promised would be a quick confirmation process. For some context on these developments, as well as the religious influences playing a role in all of this, I'm happy to welcome attorney, author, and activist Rabbi Jay Michelson back to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us again.
Thanks, Walt.
Some commentators have pointed out that Kavanaugh is as mainstream a name as Trump could ever be expected to put forward. What do you think about that?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by mainstream. All of the statistical analyses of his work, and this is somebody who has many years on the bench, so he's a known quantity, put him to the right of everyone except for Justice Thomas. I guess that's the new mainstream, but he's to the right of Justice Gorsuch on a number of issues. Interestingly, those indices are not based on the kind of hot button social issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, etc., but are really based on issues which, if you think about it, affect millions and millions of people, whether it's voting rights, the role of the administrative state, environmental law, health and safety regulations, a whole host of economic issues, and presidential power, which has gotten a lot of attention in the last few days. So, you know, this is someone who's within the mainstream in that he teaches at Yale and Harvard when he's not a judge on the D.C. circuit. And I know people who have, you know, taken classes with him, and he's a smart guy and a respectable person. But he's certainly to the far right of the mainstream when it comes to substantive positions.
There's been a lot of talk immediately about Roe v. Wade. How much of a threat to Roe v. Wade is this nomination, or is it too soon to tell?
So I'll give you a little bit of a scoop, I guess. Most people have said it's too soon to tell because Judge Kavanaugh has wisely not said what he thinks about Roe versus Wade. But we published a piece in the Daily Beast last night that I wrote that uncovered a speech that he gave not too long ago, in which he absolutely said that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided. He said it was part of a series of freewheeling judicial lawmaking and social policy. And he left absolutely no doubt that not only Roe, but the whole line of cases of which Roe is a part, which include the cases about contraception, about interracial marriage and so forth, that all of those were part of this. Again, his word was freewheeling judicial legislation. So my hope is that that will become kind of better known, and we can at least resolve this fake question of whether what his views are on Roe versus Wade. And I say it's fake because Judge Kavanaugh has been heavily vetted by the Federalist Society and by the Heritage Foundation, and they've both promised, you know, they were both sworn to overturn Roe versus Wade, and of course Donald Trump promised to as well. So it was always a fake question, but now we even have the answer to it.
How about LGBTQ rights? I'm hearing comments that range from the court could never roll back established law to the sky is falling.
Neither is true. So, you know, there is a judicial doctrine at the Supreme Court in particular called stare decisis, which is Latin for the decision stands. And that's the basic principle that that the precedent governs. Now, there are questions that the court asks when they overturn a precedent. So just last week, although it seems like an eternity ago, the court overturned a precedent on union dues. And they asked the same standard three questions that they ask in all of these cases, which is a pretty well-established test. So one of the questions is this precedent workable? And in the union case, the majority said this isn't workable because you can't really track how much of a person's union dues are going to political activities versus not political activities. How old is the precedent? How grounded in our life is it? And in this case, in the union case, it was 20 years old, but it was easy to change, which is the third question, kind of what would be the effects of this changing? So it's only that third question that in the case of same-sex marriage could save same-sex marriage. It's clear that Judge Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy means that that Obergefell was wrongly decided, even though it was written by his mentor, Justice Kennedy. There's no way that the philosophical underpinnings of that case are appealing to Judge Kavanaugh. So the only question is, how do we answer those three questions? And that, again, that may be a little bit of a doctrinal discussion, but that's what Congress needs to do. They need to actually get into the nitty-gritty, have him say on record, which he probably won't do, but to do their best to have him say on record whether Obergefell is so wrong that it should be changed or not. You know, my handicap, if I had to say one way or the other, I think Obergefell is history. It'll be gone within a couple of years.
Do you really?
It's not, you know, it's not, that's not the sky is falling, but it's about federal same-sex marriage rights. My marriage here in New York will still be valid because marriage is a state issue. The IRS will be able to do what they want to do. Red states will be able not to honor my marriage. But that's realistic. This is, you know, this is a recent case. It's one that was a 5-4 decision. And it's one that rests, again, on the same ideological grounds, really, as Roe does. The 14th Amendment, due process, and the Equal Protection Clause. Readers should read that speech that I cited in my New Daily Beast article. Just read what he has to say about unenumerated rights in the Constitution and how he characterizes these cases. There's no doubt reading that if you're a lawyer or even just an informed layperson, how Justice Kavanaugh would come down on a same-sex marriage case.
Jay, I kind of take a deep breath and brace myself, but what else do we need to know about Kavanaugh?
I think that, you know, the main thing to realize is that the abortion and same-sex marriage issue, as important as those are, social issues, there are these other issues which are really quite important, numerically speaking. So I just did another article on Judge Kavanaugh's record on environmental cases, for example. There, he's really far to the right. I mean, he's by far the most conservative, and it's hard to see what environmental regulations he would really leave standing. He has such an extreme view of how limited the EPA's authority really is. You know, I think the main issue that's getting attention now and will over the next several days is about presidential power. Maybe he has an expansive view of presidential power. It's quite likely that some case out of the Russia investigation will go to the Supreme Court. President Trump's going to assert all kinds of immunity, or maybe he's going to try to fire Mueller. Something will go to the Supreme Court. What really should happen, and this, I think, in terms of action items, you know, I think it's a lot of progressives are sort of despairing because they know that Democrats have a minority in the Senate. No matter how hard they fight, they just don't have the votes. One thing that we can really be pushing for is to demand that Judge Kavanaugh recuse himself in any case that involves Trump and the Russia investigation. It is really improper for him to be appointed by President Trump in July and ruling in a life or death matter for the Trump presidency in October, November, December. Regardless of what he's said in the past about presidential power, and he's said quite a lot, that is something that we should be demanding, and it should sort of ratchet up our priority list of things to think about, that this is not a judge who should be hearing that case. He has a huge conflict of interest. He was just appointed under this kind of shadow of, an ongoing investigation. I would argue, and I think many others have, that a president who's being investigated shouldn't be appointing a justice at all. That's going to happen, though. That's a fait accompli. So we should be asking for a recusal.
I tell you, we are grateful, everybody should be, for the kind of writing that you're doing on this. A good example is the fascinating Daily Beast article about long-term Catholic-driven efforts to remake the Supreme Court, and one man in particular who had led the effort. Would you talk for a minute about that?
Sure. So right before the announcement, I did a 5,000-word investigative article, also for the Daily Beast, under the influence of Leonard Leo, who's the kind of mastermind behind the Federalist Society, also an important figure in the Beckett Fund, which is Hobby Lobby's lawyer, the founder, really, of Judicial Crisis Network, which led the opposition to Judge Garland and which is now spending several $1 million backing the Kavanaugh nomination, and also now the George Mason University School of Law, which Leo arranged a $20 million donation to in exchange for having authority over their admissions and their faculty appointments and even their curricula. So, you know, and I want to speak carefully here because I've just been accused of anti-Catholic bias a lot on Twitter and in three response pieces and counting. This is not alleging some sinister Catholic conspiracy like the old bigotry of 100 and 150 years ago. That bigotry is deplorable, and of course I condemn it, and the last thing I want to do is contribute to that discourse. What it is doing, and none of the hit pieces against me in the last few days have disputed this, is uncovering a network fueled by tens of millions of dollars of dark money. We don't know who's paying for all of this work. A network that is not honest about what's actually happening, who's in charge of what. So Leonard Leo, rather than himself be the kind of person in front of the camera all the time, has a large number of surrogates, all of whom just so happen to be not just Catholic, but extreme conservative Catholics, members of Opus Dei. Leo himself is in the Knights of Malta. Amy Coney Barrett, who was almost the Supreme Court nominee in a sort of fringe sect called the People of Praise. These are not garden variety Catholics who are Catholic and attend Mass. These are folks who are part of an extreme anti-papist fringe. It's ironic, right? Anti-Catholicism used to be about the Pope controlling everything. But these are the folks who are actually against the Pope because the Pope is a reformer. So it's not to repeat those conspiracies. It's just to point out that this is a really powerful secret network. Secret may be too strong, but let's say a dishonest network that isn't saying where the money's coming from, isn't saying who controls and makes the decisions, and will now be responsible for four Supreme Court justices, three of whom were just put up by Leonard Leo himself.
Is this the goal, or is there another ultimate goal on this campaign?
Well, I had a source who worked for Leonard Leo for a number of years, and that's the key. This wasn't just me making stuff up. This was one of his former employees. We substantiated it with several other sources who have followed Leonard Leo for a long time. And, you know, what the source told me was that Leo and a few other folks realized that they had lost the culture war. And they realized this a long time ago, 15, 20 years ago, that same-sex marriage and LGBT equality was going to just become not just the law of the land, but also what most people supported and believed, including most practicing Christians and most practicing Catholics. That's now come to pass. And so they realized that they had lost the culture war and they needed to defend their values in the courts and stack the courts, essentially, as a bulwark. And if you look, you know, across the country, even let's just say just among people of faith, let alone the country as a whole, you find overwhelming support for a woman's right to choose. That doesn't mean people are pro-abortion, but it means that they feel like the government shouldn't be controlling people's bodies in this incredibly invasive way, forcing women to carry babies to term against their will. That's what pro-choice means. It doesn't mean you think abortion's great. Yeah. Large majorities for that, for same-sex marriage and for other hot-button social issues, let alone contraception, which is also now on the chopping block with the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh.
So, Jay, has the court been far more politicized far longer than most of us thought?
Well, that used to be an academic debate. You know, when I was in law school, we would debate between what was called, it still is called, legal positivism, which is that, you know, judges are just people in black robes. They're the ones who have this power, and they're just no different from other political actors. And more, let's say, principled defenses of the Supreme Court as an institution. You know, I think since Bush versus Gore and Citizens United, there has been a real erosion in trust in the court. And if you look at the 2017 term just ended, you know, we talked about it several times. It's just hard not to see that. You know, they're just all of these ideological decisions. The swing vote in the next few years is going to be Chief Justice Roberts, who once in a while, as Justice Kennedy did, will buck conservative ideology. He's the person who saved the Affordable Care Act, earning the wrath of conservatives. This year, he mostly went with the conservative majority, but in one case about privacy, he sided with the liberals to save a certain kind of digital privacy. So that's what swing votes do. You know, I sort of wish we had half a dozen swing votes on the court. Obviously, I like my liberal justices as a liberal, but what I really like are justices who are looking at cases in a way that's not predetermined. You know, George Gorsuch said that 100 times during his confirmation hearing. He was very charming and said, I will decide each case as it's presented to me. Meanwhile, he voted the second most conservative on the entire Supreme Court down the line. There was not a single case really where Justice Gorsuch surprised us all by siding with the liberals. So that's quite a coincidence that he decides each case as it comes, but always seems to decide a certain way. And it's sad, I think. You know, right now there's so much, the executive branch is in so much disrepute, trampling on civil rights in a way that we've never seen in this country, at least in the last 75 years. Folks feel that Congress is dysfunctional. It's certainly partisan and divided. And, you know, a lot of us look to the court system as like the refuge for the rule of law. And so it's, for me, I'm torn because on the one hand, I do want to critique when the court's making ideological decisions. On the other hand, I feel like our justice system is our last ally resisting Trumpism. And again, as a person of faith and somebody who's really motivated by what I thought were, you know, widely shared values about not breaking up families, for example. I want to see those values enacted somehow. And I think those are some of the bedrock shared values between our faith traditions and our secular government. So it's hard to find the ally that we want. And so I hope the last 2 years have been a wake-up call, not only that there is a huge difference between the two major parties, but, you know, for people of faith, progressive people of faith need to act like conservative people of faith. We need to take it seriously and take voting seriously and stop with ideological purity tests. And I don't like somebody's stance on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and so therefore I'm not going to vote for them when there is 1,000 other issues. we need to step up. People of faith need to step up our pragmatism.
Dr. Jay Michelson is a rabbi, an author, activist, and an attorney who is an affiliated assistant professor at Chicago Theological Seminary, with books that range from The Essential God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, to The Gate of Tears, one of my favorites, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay's insight is amazing. You see that in his writing for the Daily Beast, where he is legal affairs columnist, includes the recent article, The Secrets of Leonard Leo, the man behind Trump's Supreme Court pick, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Jayus is one of our more important conversations, I think, and you have enlightened us in a very helpful way. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for all those kind words, Welton.
Up next, a young activist at the Supreme Court. And later, Whosoever You Love with Bishop Gene Robinson. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. C.J. Wexler is just completing her internship at Interfaith Alliance in Washington, D.C. As the U.S. Supreme Court was declaring the Trump Muslim ban to be constitutional, a lot of us felt deep disappointment and really some outrage. What was it like for a young person committed to social justice to watch these events unfold? CJ wrote articulately about the experience for Religious Action Center website, and I wanted to hear directly from her before she heads back home to Southern California. CJ, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton, for having me here.
When did you and your colleagues get to the courthouse that night?
So I was at the courthouse the day before the Muslim ban ruling, when the rulings came down about the Texas gerrymandering and the American Express anti-steering policies. So we got to the courthouse at 2:30 in the morning. We were first in line, all 30 of us, and only 50 people are let in. So there was one more internship group that showed up around 3:30 in the morning, an hour after us. So we knew it was worth it. And only some of them were able to get in. So yeah, we set up on the sidewalk in front of the Supreme Court. We brought a lot of snacks, games, blankets, everything to keep us occupied until we were able to line up at 8 in the morning.
Can you remember, as you gathered, what your group was expecting the court to do before the ruling came down?
Yes. So for the Texas gerrymandering, a lot of us were relying on Roberts, as we usually are, to be that swing vote towards our side. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And Alito gave the majority decision, ruling that it was sound boundaries on the districts. And beforehand, also, none of us had a real understanding of the Amex case, to be brutally honest. It was very dry policy for all of us to understand. And it wasn't one of the big controversial ones of this year, as is usual. Yeah, for Texas gerrymandering, a lot of us were looking forward to Roberts ruling that it was gerrymandered, and unfortunately it didn't happen.
What was it like to hear the decision in person?
Growing up, I was always interested in government. You read and you learn about checks and balances, the three branches, and, you know, I was very naive in thinking it worked, which this summer is really proving. And gerrymandering is another example of that. Supreme Court, I thought, should have been the checks and balances on what Congress was doing and drawing those lines, and that didn't happen. And it was definitely disillusioning for me.
So when you say, and I fully understand what you say, it didn't work. What does that mean as you process what happened there and what you want to happen in the future?
I mean, right now we're looking at confirmation hearings eventually for Judge Kavanaugh, and having an executive office and executive branch that is really able to push its agenda now through all three branches,
mm-hmm.
it's scary. And it's developed a lot of distrust in the public and a lot of distrust in the system, within the system.
I really liked your writing, the way you wrote about the history in the room and the historic moments that crossed your mind. Talk a little bit more about that.
So sitting in that room, knee to knee, shoulder to shoulder with my peers, I was speechless the whole time. I knew the kind of people that had sat in those same pews and witnessed those rulings of Roe v. Wade that is now at jeopardy and so many other rulings that have changed the lives of Americans forever, very literally, the day-to-day of our lives. That kind of pressure on the shoulders of people who can make a difference and those justices that stepped into that bench that day and every day beforehand and the days to come really proves the kind of power that sits on just nine people's shoulders and how seriously those appointments have to be taken.
Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding it correctly, you were there all of that time to hear the ruling, and then you were back at the court a few hours later for a mass rally. What was that like?
The next morning was when the rulings on the Muslim ban came out and on the crisis pregnancy centers. And we were in our morning briefing here at the Interfaith Alliance when SCOTUS blog live blogged it, and we rushed over and joined Muslim advocates, HRC, ACLU, just people in the DC area, congressional representatives, in showing our dismay and grief and also expressing how we aren't going to be silent.
Mm. How important was it for you to be together with so many like-minded people at a moment like that?
It's easy to be discouraged when we keep seeing such negative headlines and we keep seeing all of the hate that is coming to fruition in policy. It's easy to want to give up and to not see reason for us gathering like that. And I had people in my life texting me and asking me, why, what's the point? The ruling already happened. It's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And the point is to show that we're not happy. Our representatives have a job, and their job is to bring our attitudes and what we're feeling and the people they're representing into policy and make that the truth and show people that there is still a fight to win. And that's what I felt when I was there with all of those people. And not only was it our representatives talking, but it was also people who organized the protests and who are still organizing rallies and letters to our representatives and showing them that we care. Mm-hmm. Only then will it follow.
How would you describe your time at the Interfaith Alliance in one word?
You got me there with that one.
Well, use two or three if you need to.
I would say my time here at Interfaith Alliance has been a time of growth and motivation.
CJ, you're talking with a person who loves Interfaith Alliance, obviously, but who is terribly worried about the future. At moments, I see a loss of the crucial values to which I've devoted the entirety of my life. What can you tell me about how you see the future and whether or not my worries are needless because of what you see coming?
Well, I can't predict the future, but I'd say your fears are needless if we continue to engage our youth. I think that is so key, and I see that regularly on my campus. I'm at the University of Southern California, and the people I see engaged are the ones who are pursuing it for their life, right? I'm a public policy major on the nonprofits track. Of course, I'm interested in the student government, and of course, I'm interested in the community outreach, but I don't see the business students doing that, and I don't see the music students doing that. And those are the students that we can engage and show them that they have a stake in this. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a stake in this for their entire lives, not only the ones who necessarily will make a career of it. And that's the base to tap into to mobilize our mission. Mm-hmm.
C.J. Weckler is a student at University of Southern California, majoring in public policy. This summer, she participated in the McCone-Kaplan Summer Program and was an intern at Interfaith Alliance. Her articulate article headlined, "Why I Camped Out at 2:30 a.m. to Watch Supreme Court Oral Arguments," appeared on Religious Action Center website, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. CJ, I know you brought a lot to your work in Washington, D.C., and I know that you will be missed. Thank you for being with us today, and best wishes for the future.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad I had this time to talk to you, and I had a very great summer here at Interfaith Alliance. Summer I'll remember forever.
As theocratic political religious right forces burrow ever deeper into the halls of power in this country, the very real threat faced by groups that they've loudly denounced for decades continues to grow. Misapplied religious rhetoric has been particularly powerful in marginalizing and endangering LGBTQ Americans in particular. Whether we're talking about court cases, bathroom bans, or escalating violence in the streets of our nation. And so with the generous support of the Arcus Foundation, this week we're launching a series of conversations that we're calling Whosoever You Love as a concerted effort to defend both our fellow Americans and Scripture against the attacks of the political religious right. Our premier guest on Whosoever You Love could not be more appropriate to the task. Right, Reverend Gene Robinson was the first openly gay man consecrated a bishop in the Episcopal Church and led the Diocese of New Hampshire until his retirement in 2013. A gentle but fearless warrior and inspiring voice for inclusion and respect. And I am so happy to have him back with us again. Gene, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Weldon, I am so delighted to be here. Thank you.
It's possible that for a time, things may change for the worse. Progress could be rolled back. But it's critically important that people don't change back, that LGBTQ people don't let their pride and sense of self-worth be diminished. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that we are coming into what is going to be a time of trial for us as individuals and as a community. You know, prior to coming here as vice president of religion at Chautauqua, I worked as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And for about the last year, I worked on the notion of dignity and tried to pull that apart in a way that would help me and us understand it better. And little did I know during that year of work that it would become so relevant to the times that we are now in. We talk about human dignity, but there are actually two sources of dignity. One is intrinsic and one is extrinsic. And so the intrinsic one is the sense of worth that we feel from the inside out, right? And as a religious person, of course, I would say remembering that I am a child of God, that I am beloved beyond anything I can imagine, and nothing would ever change God's mind about that.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you're not a religious person, it is certainly the case that we have a sense in which we have as much a right to be in the universe as does anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that intrinsic sense of worth. And then there's extrinsic dignity. And that's That's what comes our way from other people. And we have had the luxury in the last few years as an LGBTQ community to have increased our extrinsic dignity. That is to say, as we have become more and more accepted by our families, by our peers, by the culture, we have gotten a lot of affirmation and inclusion and just positive regard from the culture, from outside ourselves. And given what's looking to be like a fifth conservative voice on the Supreme Court, we may be entering a time in which that extrinsic support and affirmation is in scarce supply. And that kind of inevitable progress that I think we mistakenly thought was inevitable and that things would just get better and better and better, that's going to turn out not to be true. And for a while, it's not going to be better. And so I guess what I would say about that is that it is going to be really important for LGBTQ people and our allies that we shore up the intrinsic dignity, that is to say, our sense of worth that comes from the inside, and prepare ourselves for a time when less of that sense of dignity is going to be provided to us by the culture. And so I think this will be a time of testing for our community, and it will be especially hard for younger LGBTQ people who have never lived at a time when that kind of dignity was in such short supply. And so that'll be a new experience. And I think older LGBTQ people will need to mentor the younger members of our community in staying in touch with that dignity which comes from being a child of God.
So be very specific about what people are going to have to do, people in the LGBT community, people are going to have to do in order to accomplish what you've just said they must accomplish.
I think it's going to be a time when people have to stick to whatever spiritual practices they have, or if they don't have any, or they haven't done them in a very long time, they're going to have to get acquainted with some, whether that be for those people that would not claim any particular kind of faith to meditate on the goodness of the universe and on our standing in it and our right to be here. But especially for people of faith, I think we've got a leg up on this thing if we are people of faith, because we are used to saying our prayers. We are used to being reminded in our prayers, and when we read our sacred texts, we are constantly reminded of God's high regard for us. Mm-hmm. And now, this is hard for people of faith in a country that started out with preaching like sinners in the hands of an angry God, right? Mm. I mean, that just distorted what God's actual attitude towards us is. And so we need to be saying our prayers and reading those sacred texts to keep reminding ourselves that we are, in fact, the apple of God's eye, and that God delights in us, all of us, and reminds us that God delights in God's LGBTQ children, as well as everyone else. Hmm. That is going to shore up that kind of intrinsic dignity. So I would say prayer, I would say meditation. I would say that whatever you call community for yourself, those who surround you, to actually talk about this, to talk about how the world can chip away at that kind of intrinsic dignity. And here's the special thing about extrinsic dignity for us as LGBTQ people. The thing that gets condemned by religious conservatives and fundamentalists and so on is our sexuality. And our sexuality is such a central and integral part of who we are. It feels like a criticism and a judgment and a condemnation of our intrinsic worth. So in that sense, because our sexuality is so involved in who we are as a human being, that it feels like both the extrinsic and the intrinsic dignity are under attack. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to be ever more careful to nourish that side of ourselves, because I think we're in for a time when the extrinsic dignity coming our way is going to be in short supply.
Gene, I think what you've said is so important, and there is another reason that that's so important. So many LGBTQ people think of religion as a weapon that has been used against them, and what you're talking about is authentic religion, and where there is authentic religion, there are sources of help for dealing with this kind of hour.
That's exactly right. It is astounding to me, although I suppose given human nature's tendency to distort things, that our image of God has been shaped so profoundly by those who take the dimmest view of God, if you will.
Yes.
Going back to that famous sermon of Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, not only did that preacher say that we're being dangled over the fires of hell by God on a string as thin as a spider web,
mm-hmm.
and you get the impression from his sermon that God would just delight in letting go and letting you fall into the flames of hell.
Mm-hmm.
That is in the American psyche, and I would bet that a vast majority of those who have walked away from their churches and have been treated poorly by them, that is the image of God that they've been given. Yeah. And you know what? I wouldn't follow that God either,
right.
Because that is a cruel and cynical and angry God. And my experience of God is just the opposite of that.
Yeah.
And so I do think that LGBTQ people will need to seek out those places which don't hesitate to talk about God's goodness, God's unfailing love for us, for them, no matter where we are in our journey. And maybe this is a time for those who have left whatever faith tradition they grew up in and find another version of it that is supportive. And we've been in this struggle for long enough now that in virtually every world faith, you can find a community that speaks of God's love for us as LGBTQ people. And it may be time that we find those communities again.
Gene, let me be personal with you. I know that like many other inspiring teachers, you are also a committed learner. So what are you learning during these challenging times? What wisdom are you drawing from the ways our world has changed? And so where are you drawing hope?
Yeah, so let me tell you one of the things that is so discouraging to me, and my greatest learning in this time, I never would have thought it possible that our democracy could be so fragile,
mm-hmm.
and could be changed so dramatically by one person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have too easily underestimated the forces of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is doing for me is it's making me take another look, so that my hope is not just something that comes out of la-la land and mm-hmm. is sort of floating up there, but it's actually rooted in reality. And the reality is there's a lot of hate in the world, there's a lot of selfish motives in the world, and there's a lot of cruelty in the world, and there's a lot of thinking that I can be better in the world if I make you worse off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the spirituality that we need for these times needs to be realistic in that way and needs to take evil and selfishness and cruelty seriously, because the God I know and love and welcome into my life is not a poor match for that kind of contest. My God is strong and powerful and actually offers the antidote to that kind of way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the world at the moment is going to be a more dangerous place to speak forward and to speak in favor of that kind of God, a God who loves brown people at our borders, a God who loves families and would never tear them apart, and a God who loves God's LGBTQ children and would never, ever change God's mind about that. This is a time that I think, I know for me personally, it is a time for me to sit quietly and stop talking to God, because, you know, God already knows everything that I know. So I'm just telling God things that God already knows, to keep my mouth shut, to sit quietly, and to let God love me, right? I mean, that's what God does best. So what I do in my own prayer life is I sit quietly, keep my mind from doing, you know, a grocery list for later this afternoon, or thinking about this, that, or the other thing, and just let God love me. And sometimes it's for a minute, sometimes it's for 5 minutes, sometimes I lose all track of time and it's 30 minutes. But what it does is that it fills up that reservoir of intrinsic dignity that comes to me because I am a child of God. In a way, it fills me up so that I have the fuel and the energy and the positivity that I need to go out into a world that is more hostile at the moment. And without that, I think I would lose hope. I would lose the sort of the big picture of where we're headed, which is full inclusion of all of us, including LGBTQ people, both in the life of our religious congregations as well as in our society. And that's the food that LGBTQ people need for this journey at this time.
Whosoever You Love is the name we've given to this new interview series we're doing. And I hope, and I think you do know, how important it is for our listeners and far beyond to hear what you're just saying. You know, and I know, that there are lots of people in this world, Gene, who have never heard, and certainly if they ever heard it, don't understand what it means to sit quietly and let God love them. You've got to keep talking about that. Tell them how best they can deal with the targeted hate they experience and come out of it with the sense of being loved that you've just mentioned.
It was 15 years ago last month that I was elected bishop in New Hampshire in 2003. And for a period of time, I was getting daily death threats, sometimes multiple death threats in a day. And, you know, there's no training for that. Mm-hmm. There's no ramp-up time for that. Just all of a sudden, there you are in that situation. And I had a spiritual advisor who helped me with my prayer life at that time. Her name is Margaret Bullitt Jonas in Massachusetts. And she was the one who suggested this technique to me about sitting quietly in a chair, keeping your mind as blank and as open as possible. And the image she used was sit there and imagine God's love as either warmth or light, starting at the top of your head, and then I love this phrase, she said, and let it ooze over your body like warm butter. Which is, you know, when I first heard it, I thought, well, how silly is that? Well, let me tell you, it's an astounding experience. And you'll find your mind wandering, and so if that happens, you just stop and go back to that image. Close your eyes, imagine God's love oozing over your body like warm butter. And it's a mystery. I don't know how it works, why it works, but I know that it does work. And it gives God some space in your life and in your thinking and in your heart for hearing again God's love for us and then appropriating it, right? God can sit there loving us all day, But if we don't appropriate it, if we don't let it in, then it's not going to benefit us all that much. And God will be doing all that loving in some sense in vain, because the only way we can take advantage of that and be strengthened by it and be empowered by it is to let it in. And you have to stop long enough to let God in. And my experience is when you invite God in, God comes in.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. He's the author of numerous invaluable books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, and In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Since last year, Gene has served as Vice President and Senior Pastor of the Chautauqua Institute in upstate New York. Time spent with you and listening to you, the authority with which you speak comes because you know both hate and you also know the kind of love that you've talked about oozing over your body like warm butter. Thank you for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
I'm so delighted to have been here, and the sound of your voice makes me smile all over.
Thank you, man. Whosoever You Love, our new series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion, is supported in part by a grant from the Arcus Foundation. It's a conversation you'll hear twice a month, with additional resources available at stateofbelief.com. That's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.